Well, let me tell you what I want to do. Just this is fairly broad brush that I'm going to stroke this with right now. First, I just wanted us to think together, brainstorming really. What are the common notions about money? And I'll get you started with that. That's the first thing we're going to do. And then this is just really to refamiliarize ourselves with what is going on in the thinking of the people around us. Now, obviously, I can't relate very well to the thinking of the person who's residing in a place that's far different culturally and economically than ours. But nevertheless, some of this probably applies almost worldwide. But you know, your experience in Thailand will be interesting for us as we think through what's the common notion about money. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to look at what the scriptures say about money on just, again, a fairly big picture view. You can't look at everything, but I started pulling from the scriptures just to see what do they say if you use some of the words that are best known for representing money. And so if you look at the passages that say that use money, possess, possessions, and riches and those sorts of things, there aren't as many in the New Testament as you might think. There are lots of fairly indirect references to those kinds of things, but not that many direct ones. But what was really interesting is that when you boil down all of the stuff that's taught there, or at least the biggest portion of it, you can almost get all of it in two or three passages. Two or three passages do a very good job of summarizing the big ideas that are in the New Testament. And many of them are simply a different reflection of things that we can find in the Old Testament. So we're going to take those passages and just see if we can pick down the list of the big ideas that are contained in those passages. And then I think we'll just have fun comparing those mentally with what we just finished going through. What are the notions that people have about money compared with God's ideas? And then last, you've got the real colorful thing on the back of your handout. And we're going to talk about making money. We're going to talk about making money. And then what you do once you got it. How do you get money, and then what do you do with it when you have it? And many of the notions we're going to identify, I think, are so different from what God would teach us about this. So I feel like I'm likely to benefit from you as much as what I may have already learned from my own experience and study. Lynn, thanks for making us look like we're 25% bigger than we were. We just had a great time going around and finding out a little bit about each of the people here and also asking why they're here. So I'm not going to spend any more time on that. I have no idea why you're here. All right, what are some common notions about money? I get to lead off. I'm going to pick one. More is better. More is better. It solves my problems, okay? If I can get money, I'll look better. Accumulating possessions. Let me ask you this. This is not going to work, it would appear. It's not going to matter. Is it distracting to have it on?
No.
No big deal, right. Okay. What are some other common notions? Money makes you happy. I tried to debunk that one indirectly earlier today, but... you need it to live, yeah. So... But can you get happiness with it? Yeah. What are some other commonly held notions? Go ahead. Think about some of the stupidest things you hear, or even some of the things you think have an element of truth in them, but they really aren't quite true. Or maybe they are. They're commonly held notions.
The
stimulus package that
I
read to
you, can you just make money?
I mean,
can you just manufacture money out of the blue?
Yes, you can. I've seen the process. Okay.
Most people think that you can't have too much.
I think that's right. Most people say you can't have too much.
Americans have a lot of requirements to be happy, is what I have noticed. And they've got to have their things around them.
content as he can be.
Life's an assurance, been working in the bank. They just don't. Other people out of our culture don't have that many requirements.
Very interesting. You just talked about an attitude we'll talk about a little later. That's great.
Thanks. Another attitude, but there's a, in probably in this country more than others, there's almost a feeling of entitlement.
Exactly. Americans have that everywhere.
Okay. Yeah. I'm entitled to have. Good. We are, Juan, listing some commonly held notions about money. What do people think about money? I'd love to hear your perspectives. What I started with one. Tell me if this is true with people that you see and work with. More is better. Yeah. Okay. That's almost universal. I have worked with men that are at, I think, pretty much every rung of the social ladder. People that have nearly nothing, that live at poverty wage, all the way to those who have made $3+ million a year. And I've had a chance to talk with those. I don't see anybody that seems to be much different in the general views of money. Now, some people are smarter with it than others, but the views are pretty common. Well, let's take a look at some things out of the Scripture. Those are great, what you've identified. Anything you wanted to add, Juan? What do you think are common notions about money? People think this about it. Any way to get it's good, because more is better. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's take a look at these passages each in order, and as we look at them, I just ask you to identify for me the main idea as it relates to money and possessions that's from this passage. The first one is listed up there in your deal, First Chronicles 29, 11 and 12. I'm there now. Somebody read that out loud, please. Okay, what does this say about money?
Riches come from him.
Okay, there's something else that's before that even, but that's good. That's right. Riches come from God. All right? And on earth. Everything in the heavens and on earth. He owns that. That's it. That's the big one here. God owns everything. He owns everything. Do you have a question, Lynn? Okay. All right, that's the main one I wanted to get out of that. Jump over to Deuteronomy 8, 17 to 18. It mirrors a little what we saw there in the Chronicles passage. Well, we're going to get it out of another verse now. Deuteronomy 8, 17 to 18. Anybody want to quote or read? Okay, very good. And what does this teach us about money? Yeah, I like the way it says it in New American Standard. He gives you the power to make wealth. I'm not sure all of what he has in his mind there, but I think it's more than just physical strength, although I think that's a piece of it. There's mental ability as well, and perhaps attitudes that come with work. God helps to provide those. You may say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth, but you'd be wrong if you said that. All right, that's good. God gives power to make wealth. Luke 16, 1 to 13. Now, this one's got a few in it. several big principles here. Some of you who came in a little late, I just relayed to you a couple of things that I discovered as I was trying to find where in the New Testament do we learn about money. And there are a lot of things that talk about money, but the interesting thing is most of the key principles about money are contained in two passages. This was one of them, and the other one's in the 1 Timothy passage. Not all of them, but most of them. Luke 16, 1 to 13.
Jesus told his disciples there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer." The manager said to himself, "What should I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." So he called in each one of the master's debtors. He asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 800 gallons of olive oil," he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down, and quickly make it 400. Then he asked the second, "How much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat," he replied. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. "For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money."
Great. All right. I'm asking you to do some thinking in here. So think with me. What is he saying? What is Jesus teaching us about money here? And here's a clue that'll help you. The very first verse we read is, God owns it all. He owns it all. Sorry. Why did he tell a parable?
Well, that was the main way of teaching back in Jesus' time.
Okay.
Yeah,
story's great, man. I can remember the story. And later I can chew on that thing long enough to maybe pull out the stuff that's there. All right, so he tells us about this guy that's he's just one of his fellows, right? One of his slaves, I guess, in this particular case. And he gives him some money. He gives him his money, and there's an expectation for him to do something with it. So what is this guy's, the people in the story, do you think they represent somebody? They represent just common men, or they represent something bigger? Probably something bigger. It's a spiritual truth, I think, Jesus is teaching us. So what's he getting at here?
Well, some of the, I don't know whether this is what you're after or not, but some of the debts that are talked about here seem to be pretty good size debts. I mean, we're not talking about nickel and dimes.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
But it was probably could have been almost a medium of exchange back then.
Okay. Good. Well, the guy who was given the money to manage, what's his role in this deal? How do you see him? What's his relationship to the money? What do we call him?
Given?
Yeah, the guy that was given the money to take care of his master's stuff. What do we call him? Yeah. Thank you, Lynn. That was not really quite what I was looking for, but right on the money.
Well, you mean his job title? Okay.
You know, yeah. That's what he is. He's a steward. He's a manager. In other words, he ain't the owner. Now, this one's a hard one, I think, for especially the guy that doesn't know God, to get in his head. I don't own this stuff. No, as soon as he got it in his possession, he's the owner, he thinks. But this is a key point for for us to get if we're going to handle money well. I don't own this. This is not mine. You can do with it whatever you want to because you're the manager today. But you see, there's another point that Jesus makes, and that is you will be held accountable for this thing. I think Jesus is making that point very intentionally. Okay, so the third thing I listed on my bullet points here about the key principles is we are stewards. And what's the expectation of the steward here? Now, you do whatever you want to with it, right? No. How well are you supposed to do your stewardship? Yeah. Do it well. All right, so those two things I put together on that line. We are stewards, expected to manage well. Do you think God's okay with you if you have $10,000 and you don't, you know, you earn 2% interest and the other guy has $10,000 and he doubles it? Does he care about that? That's right. Yeah. You're expected to manage well, not just be an also-ran. I know enough about money to keep myself out of trouble. That's not good enough. That's not what God's looking for. All right. How does God... I find this to be one of the most fascinating parables because Jesus, through the parable, praises something that maybe to us looks like something we wouldn't think he would praise. What does he praise? Shrewdness. What does that mean? Okay.
And he knew how to, what would you say, make people, what do you say, beholding to him?
Beholden,
indebted to him.
Yeah. Okay. How did he use money?
He used it to buy friends.
That's right. He used it to buy friends. Now, I have put it in terms that I think may help to see the power that money can have in what we're doing when we're interested in influencing people for the kingdom of God. Use it as a tool, a lever into men's hearts. Is that okay? Yeah, that's shrewd. What he said is the sons of this age are more shrewd in regard to this, to the mammon of unrighteousness, as it says in the King James, I guess, than are the sons of light. And I think he's saying it shouldn't be that way. We ought to be shrewd. We ought to be able to use money well, not deceptively, not in a mean-spirited way. But, you know, one of the things I do it at least 5 times a week. I buy people coffee. Big deal. I buy them good coffee, you know, not that trash. Not that trash they make in, never mind. I better be careful what's on tape here. I'm from Louisiana, you know, when we make coffee, we make something you can't see through. No, yeah, at least. We actually have a little bit better one in our neck of the woods. Aspen is the local chain, and they do a good job. It's as good as Starbucks, a little cheaper. Yeah, so I buy good coffee, and I am doing it not to make a man entirely beholden to me, but it does give you an opportunity to talk. He just feels comfortable because, in a sense, your gift has given you opportunity to spend time with him and to hear him talk. He won't give you 5 hours because you buy him a coffee. $3 coffee is not good for 5 hours. It's an appropriate exchange rate. Use it as a tool. Money is to be used as a tool, a lever for good influence.
You know, you can also, I think maybe go to borrow and you can get almost over and take over on the driver.
Yep.
One of the things that people, I think, feel badly about is if you're going out with somebody on a regular basis or something like that, if you don't let the other guy take his part, it becomes almost an insult.
Yeah. Well, there's a... That's good, Dick. That's good. And I have no intention of trying to convey the idea that we ought to be buying people favor all the time. And just so you're clear on where I stand on this deal, Jesus did not give out donuts to get people to be disciples. And I ain't doing that either. I don't mind using money for influence, and that's what we need to be thinking about. How can we influence people's hearts? Not how can we buy their favor to stay with us. If a guy doesn't stay around Jesus and around you because he wants to give his life to the cause of Christ, donuts aren't going to help. Okay? What does your management of money demonstrate according to the parable? Might have to go review the parable just a little bit. Okay, that's right. It demonstrates faithfulness. Do you think God is watching what you do with money? Now, there's some very interesting things about what Jesus seems to be teaching us a man can expect if he is faithful. If you're faithful, what can you expect? Yeah, but he says something very specific. What does he say? That's right. If you're faithful in a little thing, you'll be faithful also in much. More opportunity. Right. Very good.
Be counted on for a larger opportunity.
How many of you supervise people? Okay, so do you give your tough assignments to the guy that messed up the last one? Ain't happening. I don't have time. You know, I don't have time. I've got to give it to the guy who's good at it. And God's looking at us the same way. Verse 11. Take a look at verse 11. Read that out loud. Juan, would you read that?
Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to you or to your trust the true riches?
So if we are faithful, let's put that in other terms, put it in a positive way. If we're faithful with money, what might we expect? That we'll have true riches entrusted to us. What is that? Huh? I know I can't buy eternal life, so is that it? If I'm faithful with money, I'll have eternal life? Is that what the true riches are? Say it again. Okay. I think he may have something else in mind here. I think that's it, Dan. I really do. And I kind of have in my mind, what is precious to God? What are truly valuable things in God's mind? You can tell by what he died for. What did he die for? The souls of men. I think that if we're going to disciple people, we have to demonstrate that we're faithful with money. And I'm not sure that that there's any kind of a direct relationship, but there may be. I just offer to you the possibility that God may be watching our money use as a test of whether or not we're capable of handling men and women, too.
My translation says wealth, which to me, I think money is a subset of wealth.
Yes.
But wealth also involves possessions.
Yes.
Cars, or property, or homes.
So it may have other riches, other types of riches. He may have had those in mind. Yes.
God, because they don't want people walking on the carpet. They don't want to have people, I mean, those are the kinds of things I know I deal with, Particularly if someone says, can I borrow your truck? I'm thinking, you want to borrow my truck?
Yeah. You try not to laugh in their face, right?
So it's money, and it's everything else we hold as value.
Yeah, I'm kind of relating this back to something else that Jesus said. He said, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. How do you do that? I think at least part of it is working in the kingdom, using the stuff that we have, the possessions that we have, for something that's way bigger than this temporal. Okay, great ideas. Anybody have any other ideas you wanted to add to that? Your management of money demonstrates faithfulness. Faithful managers can expect to have true riches entrusted to them. That's the main point I think we need to make there. Okay. Let's jump over, well, let's, I guess there's one other. Let's jump over to the next passage. Let's go to Colossians. Colossians 3, 23 to 24. I'll read that out loud. Whatever you do, do your work heartily, as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. What do you think's the point here? What's the main point? Put it in short words, summary words.
Diligent.
Be diligent. Great. Work hard. You're serving God. Okay? That was pretty simple. Let's jump over to Proverbs 10:4. We're going to be coming back to 1 Timothy, so this will be the last place in the Old Testament. Proverbs 10:4. And just a repeat of what we just talked about, Dick.
Make a man poor, but diligent hands bring wealth.
Okay. You know, when you think about diligence versus slackness, it brings to my mind something that I observed regularly when I worked in the management of a chemical company. We had good men working for us, good men and women working for us in many ways, and yet there were a large portion of that population, too many, I'm afraid, who, if you could catch them thinking that nobody's around, they weren't working. And what I see here is that the guy who works diligently no matter what's going on, he doesn't have to be prodded. There's something special about him, and there's something very distinct about the guy who's slack in his work. And so we do need to work hard. God rewards those who do. Poor is the guy who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. I was always happy to find employees working, and you just want to, you know, you want to thank them for their work because you know that they're putting their hearts into it. It really matters. 1 Timothy 6, this is the other passage in the New Testament that contains just a bunch of stuff that summarizes well many of the key principles that are in the Scriptures. 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 11. Dan, would you read?
Yeah. But godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, but some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs.
Then 11 and then 17 to 19. Read 11 and then 17 to 19. Right.
Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed.
Great.
NASB. Yeah. There was some extra inspiration on that day. Extra biblical inspiration. I'm sorry.
Great. At least maybe he feels free. Comfortable. Okay. Give me some of the other There may be some repeats here of things we've already identified. Give me some other main ideas that are contained here about money.
You can't take your money with you.
Can't take it with you. That's a good one.
Well, you know, when it says they pierce themselves with many sorrows, the love of money, and I use that verse when I teach finances at the school, and I said, you know, have you seen all these people with piercings? I said, it's not like it's something that, you know, is going to disable them, but it's just a little irritation the whole time. There's always just a little irritation or something that hurts when you pierce something. And I said, it's just always kind of, I don't know, just not quite right.
Yeah, it's a great picture, isn't it, of something that happens when we don't do it right. Okay, other ideas? All right.
If I'm hoping something, I want to hope something that can be certain.
How much money do you have to have before you quit wanting more? What's the threshold where people quit wanting more?
Rockefeller said it's the next million.
Okay.
You know, years ago I heard Gene Moore say, who has enough, the man with $1 million or the man with 7 daughters? He said the man with 7 daughters because he knows he has enough.
That number would be two.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is a mindset. Do you have enough? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
so
that's what I was alluding to earlier, when you just think you can't ever have enough. You can't ever have enough.
Right. Right.
You know, it seems like the question is what for us brings happiness and contentment. I think they're fairly similar concepts, you know, happiness or contentment. You know, if our resolution of that is in godliness, becoming like Christ, then we're going to be happy. We're going to find what's enough. But if it's in wealth and money, it's always more to be had.
Yep.
Well, and you know, you were talking about your pickup. You didn't want someone to borrow your pickup. You drive a 10-year-old pickup, and you don't care who borrows it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you have something. Yeah, sure, take it. Do whatever you want to. It's all perspective, isn't it?
And our matter where our hope is.
Yes. So you identified something for us. It's one of the keys I wrote down. We better not love money. Don't love money. Don't desire, and I think a better term that communicates in our language, don't lust for riches. Don't crave to be rich.
But you know, we do. We have this comparative thing going on in our premise of you. If we afford the video, we'll not help people over here. You know, so we have the struggle of wanting more. The challenge is, okay, my choices.
Right. Yeah, one of the things we did at the beginning, and I'm sure that what you're doing naturally is you're comparing. At the beginning, we listed the common notions that people have about money, you know, and boy, they're all over the place, wild and different from what we're reading today. Good. Well, that's true.
I know. And I didn't write it to a point of having a hand. I just didn't write it so well.
It's a small thing, but we're trying to tackle the mindset where we are at OSU with the students we have. And one of the things we are going to try to do is help the guys get, especially the guys. I talk about the guys because I'm working with guys. I'm not working directly with the ladies. We want the guys to get basic skills, you know, in how to do the kind of things that a man ought to do that are worth something to a family. Like change your own oil. You know, some guys don't even have any idea there's an oil plug down there. They just don't know. And it's okay. But we're not going to let them leave our university without changing oil if they hadn't. And we're going to learn a little bit about tools, you know, and which ones to use. No, that's not a Phillips head. That's a slotted. You know, because we feel like a guy needs to have some basic skills because they're valuable. Great. You see here another key principle concerning money, and that is we need to be content. It's been talked about in several ways. And to be generous. God expects us to be generous. Okay, I think we've picked out most of the biggies, so let's turn your piece over to the stuff that's got color on it. And let's just start thinking about work and other ways to get money, and what do you do with it when you have it? Somebody help me with, when are we supposed to be done here? I don't have my pamphlet in front of me. 11:40. Do you know what the scriptures say about how to accumulate money? About how to accumulate money? Little by little. You know where that is? Yes, Proverbs 25. I think it's 25. 24, steady plotting brings prosperity. Hasty speculation brings poverty. Okay? What else does it say? Consider the ant, you sluggard. Go to her. Look at her. Consider her ways and be wise. Yeah. What does the ant do? Okay. It gathers in the right season, and it works hard without having to have a king or ruler kicking it around, you know, and telling it what to do. Okay? How does that relate to us? If the ant's working hard in the summer, how does that relate to us? You can't. You maybe can't work in the same way as you could. You can work very hard when you're young. You need to do it. When you're young, you need to do it. All of us are, you know, starting to push something that's outside of being young, and so we need to be ready to help young people understand that there's value in working hard while you're young. I can remember the transition for me when I went from kind of being one of the assets in the plant to being one of the critical assets in the plant. I had been an engineer. A project was in front of us. It was big. I think it was $2 million that we were spending. And the person that was put in charge of it didn't have a third of my experience, and they didn't have any competence. And the project was going down the tubes. It was becoming a real failure. And I stepped in just because I had to. They already kicked the person who was running the deal off. And I went from working 8.5 hours a day to working 14 in one day. And I did that every day, almost every day. It was either 6 days a week or 7 days a week for about, 10 or 15 weeks. I remember it was an interminable time. I learned a lot of lessons. I made a lot of mistakes. But I had the capacity to do it. And I didn't realize I did. I was unaware that I could. I didn't think I could pull that off. You know, I was just, I thought I was barely making it. The truth was, what I'd do is I'd work on about 4 to 6 hours of sleep a night until the weekend, you know, and I valued the Sundays that finally did come, you know, where I didn't have to be out there. And I'd sleep 4 to 6 hours for a nap. And I caught up. You can catch up, you know, it's possible to do that. And that's not good for you long term, but it's possible. The Bible says some things about work besides what we've already mentioned. I'm asking you to tell me what you know. What does the Bible say about work? Yeah, go to the ant, O sluggard. Don't be a sluggard. Work in the season of life where you can. What else does it say?
You see a man
Excellent. Yeah. There are those who are skilled and those who are not. And I don't want to be one of the guys who's not. Because if you're not skilled in your work, you're the last guy they go to, and you just kind of get a reputation. How do you develop skill in work? Does God just throw that thing at you? You know, you just lay on the couch one day and suddenly you're skilled. How does it happen?
Experiences.
Partly. Think about this. How do you get skill in carpentry? By just going to the job? You do it, and you learn new things, new techniques. You practice.
You have to think about when you do a job. You think about how can I do this better.
Right.
Helps to work for someone who's skillful.
Great.
The art.
That's right. Great. Go to people who do it, practice it, and keep figuring out how to get better. Heard about a fellow who. There are pieces of this story that I know are likely not entirely accurate. I only tell it for the idea of what you can do. Apparently, this man was a very skilled carpenter. He didn't have much money. He lived, I think, somewhere in the Middle East, and he was asked to work for one of those princes, you know, and build a table. And I mean, he had like three tools. He had a chisel. He had a saw. And maybe he had a hammer or something else. And the guy was turning out the kind of work that I would expect to see out of a top-end cabinet shop, you know, with guys that that have everything. But he did it all with his hands because he learned how to do stuff well and to be skilled. Give me some experiences that you've had that have given you an opportunity to develop skill, and you have. Do you have some like that? You've developed skills just because you kind of applied yourself to stuff. Tell me about some of those, would you? Okay.
That's it. But playing an instrument.
Now, can you play? I can give you a piece of music and you can play it. Most. Yeah. Okay. So here's what most people think about that, about playing piano. They say, oh, I just wish I could play the piano. You know, you're just so gifted. Now, people don't have any clue, I don't think.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah.
And many times people are asked, you know, if you have one regret at the end of life, and a lot of them will say, I never learned to play an instrument. Yeah, my regret is I wish my instrument was something I could carry around with me, you know, like a violin or something small. Because there have been places I would like to be to have been able to play the music. So.
Great. Good example. Okay. Anybody else? All right, I'm going to give you two more. Don't gain what you get. When you work, don't work by fraud, and don't attempt to get what you get by usury, you know, by extracting money. In other words, if there's someone who needs money and you recognize this is my opportunity to make money off of them, and you use that, you abuse the place that you're in, both of those are bad ways to make money. All right? Yeah. Yeah, I'm saying that don't get work, don't do your work, and try to gain money in ways that are dishonest.
You know,
God really is watching that deal.
Ethics. I mean, I've seen that in the culture we live in. But you know what? Then when I came back here, it seems like the same things happened here. Do you all feel like that, or is it just me? Because
it's getting worse.
15 years, and you know. And the interesting thing in our business is, in 15 years, we had one person that didn't pay, that didn't like the service, and they didn't pay. And I thought, and we never had a check bounce or anything from a customer, and I thought that was pretty amazing over that period of time. And, but you know, I don't know if that would happen. I mean, that was some time ago. I got out of that business in 2000. And I see in the culture I live in now, yeah, they'll gig you if they can. But some people will and some won't, just like that here. But when you teach ethics, they do not understand business ethics.
Yeah.
I tried to do a little course on that and they couldn't understand, except one guy who was a Christian in the class, who was an architect, and they were talking, one of the ethics was on, would you hold back, would you cut materials in order to make a deal? said, never, never in a structure. Hmm. He said, maybe on the inside. And the rest of them are kind of, oh. But that's a real problem, ethics.
You know, I think, Linda, one of the reasons for that is our hope is in money. And
yeah.
When a person is not an ethical person, looks at people who use manipulation, deception, and devious ways of making money, and they realize those people make more money than they are, and you know, and your hope is in money, then you easily compromise towards that. Well, I can be like that too, and there's perfectly nothing wrong with it because.
And they've been successful. Yeah.
Yeah, they're successful. Look at how much money they have. Their pile's pretty big.
Right,
you know. So I think our culture has moved. One of the continuing problem of moving from being a God-centered country to a materialistic country is our hope is transferred to the temporal.
And you know, Americans are so subtle in their idol worship. And you know, in Asia you have spirit houses. Everybody knows you worship idols, and it's very obvious. Here we're so subtle on what our idols are, like money, houses, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I tend to be a minimalist by nature. That's what I would like. And see, my husband's kind of a total junk freak. He loves junk around him. And but you know, so things don't really draw me that much naturally. But yeah, it's just amazing the idol worship here.
It is.
We don't call it that, though, because
that's right.
That would be too unacceptable.
I've been progress.
There you go, Will. We can't.
I've been sort of impressed recently, at least in my profession, being a CPA, there's a high degree of trust required by the public in the services that we render.
Yes, exactly.
And that trust has been violated in recent years because of all of the public stuff that's gone down.
Enron.
You know, others that have suffered where public accounting firms have issued payments and everything's gone.
Yeah.
And then you find out 6 weeks later everything's not gone. Teaching people to be ethics without an ethical account, a spiritual basis, really tough sell because there's not a. People say, why? Why is it?
That's right.
If I'm going to be ethical, why should I be ethical?
Sure.
And the secular world doesn't have a good answer for that. I mean, that there is, well, you can make more money. And so it comes back to kind of a circular.
Well, the basic thing is because someday you're going to have to tell God why you did that, and you don't want to say it. You don't have to say it.
In a secular person's mind, God is in factor.
Solomon identified even, you know, this truth that I've seen men who obtain wealth by fraud. And I believe it, I don't remember which one it was. Maybe it's in Ecclesiastes, but I took a look at that and I realized, you know, maybe it was David that was saying that. I realized that his end was coming, you know, and that all that stuff he wasn't going to take with him, that he was going to stand before God and have to deal with that. And you're right, that's an answer that just doesn't help the secular guy. Nevertheless, here is the thing that does convince the secular guy. Yeah, some of those guys are making money. But you know what? When you're honest with your finances and when you do work hard and when you treat people with respect and your business flourishes, God blesses that. And when God blesses godly men, it does at least attract attention enough to where we have an opportunity to say why we're where we are. You do better generally if you go that route. More people do better generally. It looks to me like population-wise, you know, statistically. And when they go at it that way, oh, there's some guys that are running drugs, you know, that are making a lot of money, but they get caught, they get in jail, you know, and don't get to enjoy all that wealth. So it's a different approach, but a good one to do it honestly. Most of you, I think, have a pretty good idea about some stuff here. The stuff that I've just presented this in sort of a big picture view. You got to work to get your stuff. You don't go stealing it from people. You don't go gambling to get your $1 million. A lot of people that think that's an okay way to go at it. You know, if you don't play, you're not going to make it. You're not going to get it. Yeah, but that's not the way God wants us to get money. He wants us to steadily accumulate wealth by working hard and becoming skilled in our work. Once we have it, what do we do with it? There are three basic categories of stuff that I've identified here. One is outgo. I basically need to spend wisely. We could probably spend an hour just sharing ideas about how you spend better. One thing I wanted to talk about, I don't know if anybody shares my view. I'm not sharing it as the view to use. I'm just sharing with you my view. I'm not really a budgeter. You know, a budget is you say what you're going to spend every year, and then you compare to your budget and all that sort of thing. Here's what I do. I have tracked my finances with the kind of clarity that lets me know where every dime is going every once in a while. And I use that as an opportunity to say, where do I need to make the big adjustments? And what I do is I say, I can't continue to spend in this way, on this thing, you know. And so I just make major adjustments and make sure that my spending is inside. And I also have a rough plan. I'm going to save. I'm going to save 10 to 15 to 20% of what I make. I'm going to give. I'm going to give at some level. If you can run it that way, fine. If you can't, you need to have a budget. Do what you need to do, but you've got to spend wisely. Then you've got to give generously, too. Okay, but here's the big point I wanted to make about all this stuff.
Most college students, guaranteed, they're not going to have that business.
That's right. And because we're old and have a lot of this knowledge, here's what I want to challenge you with. In order to be, I want you to talk here. Can you hang your idea? Hang on to your idea. Jesus said in Matthew 28, 19 and 20, go therefore and make disciples. The command was make disciples. And then he told us how to do it, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, help them to come to know Christ, teaching them to observe all that I've commanded you. Teach them how to obey. Among the things that we must do to obey God is we must know how to handle our money. Now, there are folks around you, there are some young people, surely, that you know, that don't know how to handle money. I want to ask you, is it okay if you're a not-so-good teacher of how to handle finances, if you know how to handle finances? In other words, is it okay for you to not be able to teach it well or to not teach it to those who need to know it if they're disciples? It's not acceptable. We have to teach it and teach it well. And so I want to challenge you to find ways to package what you know, to distill your ideas and to put them into the hands and into the lives of the people that you know. Don't hold it to yourself. You won't be doing what Jesus told us to do if you hold on to it. So make sure that you find ways to teach it and teach it well. Let me hear your thought, Betsy. What was your question?
When I saw this give generously, this is one issue my husband and I see a little differently. Let me give you an example. The people that you'll find on the street corners with the homeless sign, you know, need money. I'm the one, I'm ready to
give them.
Yeah. And my husband, no, because he didn't know what he's going to do with that money. And so, I mean, it happens every time we drive up the hill, I'll say, I want to give him something. it's really interesting. So I wanted to just throw that out to you knowledgeable, wisely, godly people. What do you all handle situations like that?
Sherry and I were on vacation a week ago.
Yes.
And we had the firemen. You know the firemen
that
come by in the corner to boot,
with
the boots?
Oh,
and Sherry and I thought, you know, that's a worthwhile thing. I mean, we think that public servants, you know, that was an area where we sort of opened up and said, that's an area where we can be generous and focus on it. And Cherry started carrying prepackaged meals in the car. She does this. I don't do it, so I'm just giving testimony.
That's a good idea.
Because there's no worry about what goes on with the money. You know, it's instantaneous. I mean, if he's truly hungry, then he's going to open up that meal right there. And she's seen a number of them do that. Our son carried the meals around the car, and they just sat there.
You didn't see
our Sunday school teacher and a teacher with the president came up. They evidently had a discussion about this one time when I was not there. And last week she announced that she had little bags in the back of the room. And she'd gone out and collected things such as, or bought things, such as a buck for bronze to give people and to put some of these meals, prepackaged meals, and Saxon there and said, if you feel, if you've got that pain of guilt of driving by somebody and you don't want to give them money because you don't know where it's going, then you just hand them one of these bags. And it's got four or five things in there. There may be a little snack or something in there, but you still are sure about where it's going to go. And
then
but that's a problem that I have, because I go through the Hefner Parkway and Northwest Highway intersection 300 times a week or something. And there's always six on the corner there. Like somebody's come by in their van and let out six of them because they're all stationed at each one of the corners. That really kind of galls me. And yet I saw one of them was a lady. First time I'd seen a lady the other day. And I associated it with one of my daughters. And that really because I thought that could be Carly or Lee.
So you think it's someone doing it?
Money.
Yeah, but do you see the beggars in Thailand?
Yeah.
They're there all the time on Na Na.
Yeah.
And do you always stay in that area, Sukhumvit? Do you?
That's different areas.
Yeah, but that's a big beggar area, and it is an organized begging. Thing where they bring them, like you say, let them out. They may be missing a limb, deformed, different things, or they may be children, a woman with a baby. But see, the UN has said do not give money to the women with the babies laying there like this because they drug the children. And they said all it does is encourage them. And yeah, you see children, and I just hate to walk by it, but if I see a child selling something, I'll always buy from them. Because I know they've got to sell these things. And at least they're working. You know, I feel as though they're putting forth an effort. But I always buy stuff from the children, but I don't give to beggars.
You know, I'd just say that it's useful for us to not dissociate ourselves from the needs of our world by simply giving money. We need to sometimes get involved. You know, I've found that one of the most rewarding things is to have enough buffer so that every once in a while what I do is instead of giving a guy money, I say, get in the car, let's go to McDonald's. And I buy him a meal, you know, and I know he's eating, I know he's not buying drink with it, and I get a chance to talk with him. You know, and I don't have to share the gospel with him, but I can plant seeds or I can share the gospel with him. You just test where his heart is. So it's useful to get involved as directly as possible.
That goes back to Jesus' days.
Yeah.
You know, the beggars begging for alms.
It's hard. It is hard.
You know, and I struggle a little bit with wanting to do something that I feel is legitimate. And I would say that for me and Cherry, we have sort of, in an effort to try to find a legitimate way to meet the needs of the disadvantaged and the poor, Juan's got a high school here in Oklahoma City that is in an urban context. And there were disadvantaged African-American youths from the neighborhoods kicked out of the public school system. And this is a school of last resort. Mm-hmm. I think one of the ways we can express our willingness to engage in our social problems is by teaming with people like Juan, finding legitimate ways to meet the needs of the disadvantaged, the hungry, the out of work, the people who have problems. And I really, the more I've gotten to know Juan, and these kids, I mean, Cherry, and I hate to keep, she's the example of godliness to me in this area. She goes down with a team of ladies every Tuesday and cooks meals for these high school kids who would say, if I'm not mistaken, one that, you know, this is sometimes the only hot meal they get.
Yeah.
So to me, it's not turning our back on those who need our help. It's
but
finding
legitimate
ways of engaging and expressing our generosity.
That's good.
You know, in a way, now I don't have any worries that one's not going to use those resources illegitimately. So I think we have to engage. We have to.
Mm-hmm.
We can't sit on the sidelines and passively believe somebody else will do that. Someone else's. So I don't know what all of our contexts are. That's
good. That's good. Very good. Thank you. We don't have any more time, but we've got some good ideas out there. Thanks for your time and attention and cooperation and help.